What would you say the book of Job is all about? Well, if you told me the book of Job is about suffering, you'd be in very good company, because I think that's probably the answer that virtually everyone would give. Job is known as a man who persevered under suffering, and from the beginning of the book to the end of the book, that seems to be the theme. Hence the title of this sermon, What Have You Done? Because you see, when people face suffering in this world, that's often the question they ask of God in almost an accusing tone. What have you done? Why are you doing this to me? Why have these circums fallen to my lot? What have you done, God? But you know, the book of Job isn't all about suffering. Not according to the New Testament. And it is, after all, the New Testament that is to be our guide into a correct interpretation of the Old Testament. And interestingly, while certainly the New Testament speaks about the perseverance of Job, it doesn't focus upon his sufferings. Listen to what the New Testament says in the book of James, chapter 5. And in verse 10 we read, as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remained steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. What the New Testament focuses upon in the life of Job is not his sufferings, but upon the compassion and the mercy of God. According to the New Testament, Job is about God's love. So the question that's asked by the title of my sermon this morning comes from a different quarter. Rather than it going from us to God in the midst of suffering in an accusing tone, what have you done? It comes rather to us. What have you done? What have you done that you should need God's compassion, God's mercy? Why should God be compassionate and merciful? Why did Job experience the compassion and mercy of God, if indeed he did experience the compassion of mercy and mercy of God, as the New Testament would tell us? What have you done? What has Job done that compassion and mercy need to come from God? After all, they don't appear in a vacuum. No one deserves mercy. It would contradict the meaning of the term. Mercy is something good given to someone who doesn't deserve it. Now, as we look at this question, we need to look to Job chapter 19 and verses 25 through 27. For as many commentators acknowledge, this is the central thrust of what keeps Job going through all of his trials, through all of his sufferings. This is Job's confession of faith in God. He says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, not another. My heart faints within me. Now, this passage tells us about four things that Job knew. Four things that help to explain to us the compassion and the mercy of God. That will help us to see why it is the New Testament tells us the book of Job is about compassion and mercy, not first and foremost about suffering. So what did Job know? Well, first, Job knew that there would be a resurrection. Job knew that there would be a resurrection. Now, let me just, as a by the way, a bit of an aside, but that just acknowledges the fact that not everyone interprets these verses in terms of something that's going to happen to Job sometime in an afterlife kind of situation. That there are people who interpret this passage and see it as being fulfilled in Job chapter 42, when God stands beside Job and vindicates him before his friends who have been his accusers, who restores to him the fortune that he had had before, and in a sense gives him a new life. And they see it fulfilled in physical and temporal ways. Now, I understand that there are those who hold that view. I disagree with it myself. I think that Job knew more than that. Job hoped for more than that. He knew that there was more to life than this life, between birth and death. Why do people say that Job didn't believe in life after death? Well, there are a number of verses, a number of sections in his discourses where he seems to suggest that death is the end of it. That in a sense, almost death will be his salvation. It will bring an end to all his sufferings. And so you have passages, for example, like chapter 7 and verse 9. And he says there, as the cloud fades and vanishes, so he who goes down to Sheol does not come up. Or again in chapter 10 and in verse 21 he says, before I go and I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow. And again in chapter 14 and verses 10 to 12 where he says, a man dies and is laid low. Man breathes his last, and where is he? As waters fail from a lake, and a river wastes away and dries up, so a man lies down and rises not again. Till the heavens are no more, he will not awake or be roused out of his sleep. And he goes on to wish that he was already there, freed from his sufferings. So there are sections there. There are comments made by Job in the midst of his sufferings that seem to suggest that he sees the grave as being his escape. That's the end. That's it. Life is over. It's finished. It's done with when he dies. And people argue that if we take Job's words literally when we come to chapter 19 and verses 25 to 27, that he's talking about a real resurrection of the physical body, he's contradicting himself. Well, there's a number of explanations we could give for that. One is, for example, that those who go through tremendous trials, who are are cast into the slough of despond, to use Bunyan's terminology, often speak irrationally. They often speak in contradictions. At one moment, they're in the depths of despair. In the next moment, they're on the heights of joy. And then the next moment, they're in the depths of despair again. And it's like a roller coaster ride from having great faith in God to despairing of any faith in God. And those of you who have been through periods of great turmoil of soul will be able to relate to that. So that would be one explanation. But I don't think even that is the correct explanation. For you see, none of those passages speak explicitly about there not being a resurrection. In fact, the last one of those that I quoted to you from chapter 14 suggests that there was something more. A man lies down and rises not again. Till the heavens are no more, he will not awake or be roused out of his sleep. So he is even picturing death asleep, just as Jesus Christ will when it comes to the New Testament era. And he seems to suggest that there is an end at death, but after some time, creation itself will cease and there will be a renewal. Furthermore, his comments do not rule out the possibility of a different life. Certainly what he says is that this life will be no more. He doesn't see a resurrection to the life that he is now living. In other words, he's not expecting a resurrection like Lazarus had, or like Jairus' daughter had. People who had died and by a miracle of divine power rose again to exactly the same life, to carry on where they'd left off, so to speak, and one day to die all over again. No, Job's not thinking of a physical resurrection in that way, a resurrection to his current life. When Job speaks in chapter 19, he's talking about a resurrection to a different kind of life. A life after this life. A life separate, in a sense, from this life. Different from this life. And the fact that he viewed the possibility of a life after death is hinted at in other passages. For example, in chapter 14 and in verse 14. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my service I would wait till my renewal should come. See, again, here there's a hint that something is going to happen. There's going to be a change. There's going to use the vocabulary of the New Testament, recreation, new creation. Or slightly earlier in chapter 13 and in verse 15. Those wonderful words that he spoke. One of those high points in the midst of his roller coaster ride through suffering. He says, though he slay me, I will hope in him. Now, we often take this to mean that I will hope in him even up to the point at which he slays me. But I think a commentator who suggests that there's more depth to this may well be right. Even though he slay me, I will still, after he has slain me, I will still hope in him, or as it can alternatively be translated, I will serve him. So you see, there are hints here, despite the fact that he sees death as being somewhat conclusive to his life now as he's living it, it doesn't mean that he doesn't view the possibility of another life after death. Indeed, I would assert that Job did know that there would be a resurrection from the dead. One commentator, Gary Benfold, makes this astonishing claim: death is temporary. Death is temporary. It's not the end. It's not finality. It's just a phase that we will all go through. And of course, he's able to make that assertion because the New Testament provides far more light than Job ever had. And I think we need to remember that. When I say Job knew that there would be a resurrection, and when he comes out with these profound statements with regard to a life after death, I'm not saying that he had the same kind of understanding of the resurrection as John did, or the Apostle Paul did, or Peter, or Jude. He didn't have that fullness of revelation that they enjoyed. In fact, if we can date Job accurately at all, we would have to say that he was a contemporary of the patriarchs, lived possibly at the same time as Abraham. And certainly there are clear indications that that was the case in this letter. The pedigree of his friends suggests that that was the era in which he lived, about 2,000 years BC. Before Moses, therefore, before the Pentateuch, before Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Long before David, who wouldn't come along until 1,000 years later. So, none of the Psalms, the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles, and none of the prophets either. In other words, the revelation that we have recorded for us in Job was the first revelation of the Scriptures. No doubt recorded much later, but nevertheless reliable and true, certainly in the minds of the New Testament writers. This is authoritative God revelation. And Job then speaks from that distant point in history, but he has light. There's glimpses here of what will be more fully revealed later on. So how then does the New Testament make this clearer? Well, let me turn just to one passage from that passage that we read together earlier in John's Gospel and chapter 5. And Jesus speaks very clearly about the resurrection. He says in chapter 5 and verses 28 and 29, "Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice." Everyone, no exception, all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. There is a resurrection from the dead for everyone, without exception. Job knew that there would be a resurrection. Job speaks in terms of seeing his Redeemer, seeing him with his own eyes, not someone else seeing his Redeemer, but he himself. He's very emphatic about that in these verses in chapter 19, verses 25 through 27. He wants us to be absolutely clear that after he has died, he will yet in his flesh see his Redeemer. Job knew that there would be a resurrection. Well, oh, very well. But what has that got to do with compassion and mercy from God? Well, let's go on to the second thing that Job knew. Job knew that there would be a judgment. Job knew that there would be a judgment. That the resurrection from the dead wasn't simply to a continuing life, but that mankind would be called to give an account of their lives before God. Job says that very thing in this chapter. He sees before him a day of reckoning. He sees before him a day of vindication for the righteous and a day of condemnation for the wicked. And he warns his friends with these words from verse 28. If you say, how we will pursue him, the root of the matter is found in him. In other words, what his friends are saying is, this man, Job, who we thought to be a very righteous man, is obviously a gross sinner because he's suffering such terrible anguish at this time. Great suffering means great sin. We will pursue him because we know this matter is in him. We will dig out the root. We will find the sin. And Job says to them, be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment. You see, Job realizes, he knows there will be a resurrection, and he knows that there will be a judgment. Now, of course, as we've seen in our series, Job was confident of being able to stand before God in innocence. Job couldn't see the connection between his sufferings and any sin in his life. Not that Job claimed to be sinless, he didn't. But he denied his friend's logical fallacy that great suffering must of necessity stem from great sin. Job knew he had done nothing deserving of the suffering he was undergoing when his friends weren't suffering at all. You see, in comparison, he knew himself to be no worse than them, and yet he was suffering far more than them. He couldn't make the connection between suffering and sin. He claimed his innocence. His present suffering was not the result of his sin. And of course, we know that to be true. God himself, right at the beginning of the story, of course Job didn't know it, but God said to Satan, have you noticed Job? My servant, that there is no one like him. He is blameless, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And God uses the same vocabulary to describe Job right at the end of the book. Job was innocent. And Job looks with confidence to his resurrection, believing that the judgment would vindicate him in his assertion of innocence. But he warns of condemnation to his friends who are falsely accusing him, who are raising up charges against him that cannot be substantiated. Job knew that there would be a judgment. And of course, again, the New Testament adds clarity to this truth. The New Testament bears out Job's belief in a judgment after death. And we can see it in many places, but let me just take you to a couple of sections from the New Testament. Firstly, from Paul's second letter to the church in Corinth. In chapter 5 and verse 10, he wrote to the Corinthian church saying, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. The Apostle Paul believed in resurrection and judgment. And in Acts chapter 17 and in verse 31, at the end of that sermon that he preached in the Areopagus on Mars Hill, he says, God has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. And of course we have the words of Jesus himself in that section that we quoted from in John chapter 5 and verse 29. That there people will be raised to judgment. It is appointed to all men to die once. And after that is judgment. So Job knew that there would be a resurrection, and Job knew that there would be a judgment. And now, you see, we begin to understand why it is that James can say Job is about compassion and mercy, rather than Job is about suffering. Because the third thing that Job knew was that he needed a redeemer. He needed a redeemer. The Old Testament redeemer, as it would be clarified later on after Job, and so we mustn't read into Job what is written for us earlier in the Bible, given that it hadn't come until later chronologically. You follow what I'm saying? That we can read Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and we can take those laws and we can apply them to Job. But we shouldn't really do that because Job was hundreds of years before that. Nevertheless, those Old Testament laws do give us some idea of how Job may have understood the term redeemer. For example, the Old Testament redeemer was a near family member who had certain responsibilities. It was often referred to as the kinsman redeemer, being near of kin, being close family. What responsibilities did they have? Well, Leviticus chapter 25 explains some of those responsibilities. We're not going to turn to it now, but if you want to do so later, you can. One of the responsibilities that the kinsman redeemer had was to buy back family inheritance if it was sold due to poverty. So you've got a piece of land, and you haven't done well, your crops have failed, you've been thrown into poverty, and you need to sell the land in order to buy bread for your family. So you sell the land. But under God's rule of Israel, that land was a special inheritance for your family. And therefore, a close relative had a right to buy that land back for your family. The person who you'd sold it to couldn't say, "No, I want to keep this land. I paid a fair price for it. It's mine." No, it wasn't his. Under God's law, he was simply renting it for a time. And indeed, the price he would pay would be determined by the length of time till the next Jubilee year when he would have to give it back anyway. But in the meantime, the kinsman redeemer could buy it back. That was one responsibility. Another responsibility was that the kinsman redeemer could free a man or a family member who had been sold into slavery. Again, for the same reasons, thrust into poverty, the only way out was to sell himself into slavery. Well, a kinsman redeemer could come along and could buy that person's freedom. Another responsibility of the kinsman redeemer was to avenge the death of a murdered relative. We read about that in Numbers chapter 35 and in Deuteronomy chapter 19. Someone who had been murdered, a close relative, could be the avenger of that man's blood. And he could go after the murderer and put him to death. Now there were certain cities that were refuges for people who had slain someone in an accident, so that they would be safe from the avenger of blood. But nevertheless, there was this principle that the kinsman redeemer had a responsibility to avenge the death of a murdered relative. Now, to sum up all of these things, they were all intended to ensure the honour of the person. The honour in terms of their property, the honour in terms of their life. And to ensure the continuity of that person's name held in good regard in the community. And that in itself was a picture of atonement for sin. All of these various aspects of the Redeemer's responsibility are intended to demonstrate to us what happens when we sin. What happens? We lose our inheritance when we sin. What happens? We lose our freedom when we sin. What happens? We lose our life when we sin. The inheritance that God has given of a world that was perfect has been lost because of man's sinfulness, and it's been thrown into corruption. And we need a kinsman redeemer who will buy it back. By sinning, we have thrown ourselves into slavery. Slavery to sin. And we're no longer free to serve God. Our wills are bound by sin. And we need a redeemer who will buy back our life and free us to serve God once again. And we can go even further than that and say, by sinning, we plunge ourselves into death. We are dead in trespasses and sins, and we can no longer serve God. We can no longer do anything that is pleasing to God. We're corpses, rotting and corrupted. And we need a redeemer who will bring life where there is death. We need someone who will atone for sin. Now, exactly how Job understood the term redeemer, I don't know, I confess. There may have been some of this understanding that later was written into the law of the Israelites that Job would have had. I don't know. But there is certainly this. He understood that he needed a redeemer. He needed someone, for example, who would stand in his place and argue his cause when he no longer had strength or life to do it himself. "Behold, I cry out violence," he said earlier in this chapter, "but I am not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice." But he has a redeemer, you see. He needs a redeemer who will vindicate his name, who will restore his honour in the community. But I think, too, that Job understood that he needed a redeemer for his sin. Because right at the beginning of the book, we're introduced to a Job who made sacrifice. He understood that it was possible to sin unintentionally. He offered sacrifices on behalf of his sons and daughters just in case during one of their parties they may have spoken a word against God. So careful was Job to ensure that sin was atoned for. I am convinced that when he speaks of the Redeemer here, he had some sense of his need of someone to redeem his life from the judgment of God. And certainly that is the way we are to understand redemption from the New Testament. For example, in his letter to Titus and in chapter 2 and verse 14, Paul writes there and he says, "Jesus Christ gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness and to purify for himself a people for his own possession who are zealous for good works." And again in his letter to the church in Galatia, Galatians chapter 3 and in verse 13, he says, "Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree.'" And again, in Romans chapter 3 and in verses 23 and 24, those more familiar words to us, perhaps, where he says, "All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus." So Jesus Christ buys back that which has been sold. He redeems creation. He redeems our lives from slavery to sin. He atones for that sin and brings new life where once there was only death. Here is the mercy. Here is the compassion of God. And Job knew. He knew there would be a resurrection. He knew there would be a judgment. He knew that he needed a redeemer. And the fourth thing that Job knew who his redeemer was. He wasn't vainly hoping for someone, somewhere, to take pity on him. He knew. "I know that my Redeemer lives, and in my flesh I shall see God." Job knew that he needed a Redeemer unlike any of his family, who had turned their backs on him as soon as he had lost everything, or his friends who had disowned him and distanced themselves from him, thinking of him as a great sinner. He needed someone greater, someone whose depth of love and breadth of compassion was far more than anything any earthly person was able to offer him. And he believed God was his Redeemer. And this isn't an alien concept in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, though some would argue that it is, and that it's not until the New Testament that we understand it. But Isaiah himself, in chapter 44 and verse 6, speaks about God redeeming Israel. Job knew he needed a divine redeemer. He needed someone who could stand before God and act on his behalf. And no human being could do that. No human being was great enough or good enough, pure enough to do that. On the other hand, he knew he needed a human redeemer, someone who was able to relate to him. He speaks of this in chapter 9 and in verse 33, where he uses this term: "There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both." So the imagery is of someone who is able to stand before Job and God, and who is able to lay a hand on both, in a sense, who was equal to both, who could touch both, who could live alongside both, who was familiar with both. And in his despair in chapter 9, he could see no one. But this glorious light shines on him here in chapter 19, and he knows he has a Redeemer. He knows there is one who can sympathize with him in his weakness, and who is equal with the living God, who can lay hands on both. And of course, how much he really understood of all that he was saying, and how much was the benefit of divine revelation given to all people in all ages, I'm not sure. But what I do know is that, again, the New Testament makes this much clearer. So that there are numerous passages that we could turn to, but let me turn briefly to three. In Romans chapter 5 and verses 12 and following, we have that argument of the Apostle Paul about the first and the second Adams. The first Adam stood as our representative and plunged the whole world into sin. The second Adam, like the first, stands as a representative for his people, and he redeems them. He brings life to them. Where the first Adam broke God's law and brought death, the second Adam kept God's law perfectly and brought life. And then in Galatians chapter 4, and in verses 4 to 5. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. God sent forth his Son. The second person of the Godhead came into this world born of a woman, God incarnate, one who was equal with God, but became a man so that he could sympathize with us, identify with us, and properly be our representative before God. And so in Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 7, in him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of his grace. Jesus Christ is the Redeemer. He was foreshadowed in the Old Testament in many ways, and one of the ways was in the life of Job himself, the innocent sufferer who at the end of the book is the mediator for his friends and intercedes on their behalf. And in the pages of that book of Job, we have these glimpses of glory as God reveals his future plans and purposes. And central to that is this section in Job chapter 19, and in this declaration of faith from the lips of Job, that he knows that his Redeemer lives, and that he will see him. For Job knew that there would be a resurrection, and Job knew that there would be a judgment, and Job knew that he needed a Redeemer, and Job knew who that Redeemer was. The book of Job is about the compassion and mercy of God towards sinners. It doesn't answer the question, why am I suffering? It never answered the question for Job when he asked time and time and time again, why am I suffering? But the compassion and the mercy of God towards Job, and the compassion and the mercy of God towards us, encourages the response, trust the God who is so compassionate and merciful that he came himself into this world to take away sin and to redeem our lives from eternal destruction. What did Job have to learn? To trust a compassionate and merciful God, even when it wasn't evident to him. And what do you have to do? You have to trust a compassionate and merciful God when there is abundant evidence of his compassion and mercy. We don't grope blindly as Job did in so much of his sufferings. We have the full revelation of God. And my question to you this morning is, what have you done with that revelation?